The following is a class on the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 10, Text 26, given by His Divine Grace, Dhanavir Das Vanachari, on February 1990 in Amsterdam.
Chapter 10, Text number 26. Ashvatas sarva vrikshanam devashinam cha naradaha gandharvanam chittarata siddhanam kapilo muni. Of all trees, I am the holy fig tree, and amongst sages and demigods, I am Narada. Of the singers of the gods, Gandharvas, I am Chitrarata. And among perfected beings, I am the sage Kapila. If you have any questions as we go along, you can ask. Purport. The fig tree, Ashvata, is one of the most beautiful and highest trees, and people in India often worship it as one of their daily morning rituals. Amongst the demigods, they also worship Narada, who is considered the greatest devotee in the universe. Thus, he is the representation of Krishna as a devotee. The Gandharva planet is filled with entities who sing beautifully, and among them the best singer is Chitrarata. Among the perpetually living entities, Kapila is considered an incarnation of Krishna, and his philosophy is mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Later on, another Kapila became famous, but his philosophy was atheistic. Thus, there is a gulf of difference between them. Text 27. Uchai shravasam ashvanam vidimam amritodbhavam airavatam gajendranam naranam cha naradipam. Of horses, know me to be Uchai shrava, who rose out of the ocean, born of the elixir of immortality. Of lordly elephants, I am Airavata, and among men, I am the monarch. Purport. The devotee demigods and the demons, asuras, once took a sea journey. On this journey, nectar and poison were produced, and Lord Shiva drank the poison. Yeah. Yeah. Right, they were churning, that's right. What happened was the demigods, there are demigods which are, they're like devotees of the Lord. They're in charge of different universal responsibilities. There are 33 million demigods, and they're running things like the light for the universe, the water for the universe, the wind. There's demigods in charge of different planets. Well, they're all very pious souls. And then there are, and they follow, they're like the good government workers. Like here in Holland, you have those who work for the government, okay? And they're in an organized way. Then you also have the underground criminals, like the mafia. So the demons or the asuras, they're like the mafia. Okay, they don't care for law and order. They don't care for the laws of God. They don't care for God. And they're always fighting with the government. The government passes a law, no drugs, and they do it some other way. Okay? So that's what the asuras are. They're the demons. And the demigods are like, they're the good guys. Now, usually they're fighting. But in this particular case, they decided to cooperate together for a particular purpose. And the purpose was that they wanted to produce some nectar, and they knew how to do it. Now this nectar was called Amrita, which Amrita means death. And Amrita means without death. It makes them deathless. The thing is, this particular nectar didn't exactly make them completely deathless, but it extended their lives for a long time, so much so that they thought they were more or less deathless. Anyway, both parties wanted to get this liquid. So the way they were going to do it was, they were going to go to the ocean of milk. Now, there is a portion of this universe where there's an ocean of milk. You may find that hard to believe. Why? Because the biggest quantity of milk you've ever seen is maybe several gallons. You know, so you can't. It's hard to imagine. So the only experience we have is an ocean of salt water and an ocean, more or less, an ocean of clear water or fresh water. Okay, we have lakes like that, big lakes. But we get information from the Vedic scriptures that there are other oceans on other planets in the universe that are different. For example, there's oceans of milk, oceans of sweet water, ocean of ghee, ocean of oil, ocean of liquor. Different kinds of oceans. These demigods and demons decided to go to the ocean of milk and churn it. Just as one churns milk, he gets cream and other kinds of... From churning, you can get cream from the milk. But within the ocean, they were throwing different kinds of herbs and vegetables. And they did it in the proper way so that after churning, then this nectar would come out. It was a big plan. They were all very powerful personalities. And in order to accomplish this, it took an awful lot of energy. They needed a very big churning rod. And to summarize the whole event, in the beginning, some poison came out. In fact, a lot of poison came. And the poison was so devastating that everyone was frightened. What are we going to do with this poison? It's something like... Dai shishi goni tai. Something like what we have nowadays, and we can turn on these lights also. We've created atomic energy, and the original idea of atomic energy was to, for peaceful purposes, right? To conserve energy, to make a better life for everyone, everyone could enjoy more comforts, electricity. Everyone could live a more... Right? Because we're running out of oil and we're running out of wood. We're cutting down all the forests and all the oil. We're, extracting it from the earth and burning it up. And we're running out of different energy resources. So they thought, well, now we've discovered this atomic energy. This will be very nice. But with the atomic reactors, what did we get? Atomic waste. And the big problem with atomic waste is it doesn't break down. You can't, wherever you put it, it doesn't just stay there peacefully. It contaminates the whole place. Just like that, was it Chernobyl? Yes, where they had the meltdown. The Soviets had the meltdown. The atomic waste wasted everything in the whole area. Everyone that was in the area was devastated, and now no one can go back to that area. It's completely... So similarly, this poison that they generated from this churning was so devastating, and it was increasing, was going everywhere. They didn't know what to do. Just like this atomic waste. We don't know what to do with it, where to put it. So fortunately, Lord Shiva was there. Lord Shiva is known as Mahadev. He's most powerful of the demigods. And they humbly approached Lord Shiva, "Will you please help us?" And so Lord Shiva said, "All right." And then he drank all the poison. That's how powerful he was. He could drink the poison and neutralize it, and he was not affected. No, the only thing that affected, his throat turned dark bluish. Otherwise, he was not affected. So everyone appreciated Lord Shiva's kindness in doing that. And so poison came, and then one very nice horse came called Uchaisrava. And a very nice elephant came called Airavata. And so many different things came out. And ultimately, this nectar did come. It did come. And then there was a kind of a quarrel over who should have the nectar, and that's another story. But anyway, that's being described here by Lord Krishna. He's saying that amongst horses, he's this particular horse, because that was the greatest horse. In other words, what Krishna is doing here in these verses of Bhagavad Gita is he's explaining things in terms of the material world that we have experience of. He's saying that whatever there is great in the world, that is a representation of myself. I am the greatest that you can imagine. And this is particularly for the materialists or the neophytes who are not very advanced. Otherwise, he would just describe himself directly. I'm like this. But he's not describing himself directly. He's describing himself indirectly for our benefit. Any questions? Okay, we'll go on. From the nectar were produced many entities, of which there was a horse named Uchaisrava. Another animal produced from the nectar was an elephant named Airavata. Because these two animals were produced from nectar, they have special significance and they are representatives of Krishna. This elephant could fly in the air. And he became the carrier for Lord Indra. You see sometimes Indra riding on an elephant, Airavata. Amongst the human beings, the king is the representative of Krishna, because Krishna is the maintainer of the universe, and the kings, who are appointed on account of their godly qualifications, are maintainers of their kingdoms. Kings like Maharaj Yudhishthir, Maharaj Parikshit, and Lord Ram were all highly righteous kings who always thought of the citizens' welfare. In Vedic literature, the king is considered to be the representative of God. In this age, however, with the corruption of the principles of religion, monarchy decayed and is now finally abolished. It is to be understood that in the past, however, people were more happy under righteous kings. Monarchy formerly was the system that the whole world was governed under. It was not democracy, it was monarchy. And the kings were chosen due to their family background, but also by their qualifications. In other words, if, generally speaking, the eldest son of the former king, he would inherit the throne. That is the system of the Manu Samhita, the law book for mankind. But if the eldest son was not qualified, then the saintly brahmanas, they would not select him. They would say, no, he cannot be king. The other son should be king. They would always give preference to the sons of the king. But if the sons of the king were not qualified, then they would choose someone else. In the case of Dhritarashtra, he was the eldest son, but he was born blind. Because of his being born blind, he couldn't inherit the throne. And there was another case, Vena. Vena was given the throne because his father, Maharaj Anga, passed away. But when Vena took the throne, he was such a rascal, such a demon. He didn't follow any religious principles. He didn't protect the people. So he had to be removed. So there are cases when there are disqualified persons. But on the whole, a well-trained, qualified king is preferable. Now in present day, we're so afraid of putting too much power. They say power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. We're very much frightened of giving power to one person because we think, well, if he becomes corrupted, then we're all finished. Dictatorship. You know, Stalin, Hitler, etc. And rightfully so. It's a fact. But if we could find a person who was endowed with godly qualities and was trained in how to govern, how to manage the people, how to protect them, then that would be very nice. So that's why Krishna says, among the men, I am the monarch. Because he's called Naradeva. Naradeva means he's the representative of God within human society. He's to be very highly respected. But he has to actually represent God. Not like nowadays, the leaders, they don't care what God says. They pass their own laws. They do what they want. Text 28. Ayudhanam maham bajram denunam asmika maduk prajanaschasmikandarpa sarpanam asmivasuki. Of weapons, I am the thunderbolt. Among cows, I am the surabhi, givers of abundant milk. Of procreators, I am Kandarpa, the god of love. And of serpents, I am Vasuki, the chief. Purport. The thunderbolt, indeed, a mighty weapon, represents Krishna's power. In Krishna Loka, in the spiritual sky, there are cows which can be milked at any time. And they give as much milk as one likes. Of course, such cows do not exist in this material world, but there is mention of them in Krishna Loka. The Lord keeps many such cows, which are called Surabhi. It is stated that the Lord is engaged in herding the Surabhi cows. Kandarpa is the sex desire for presenting good sons. Therefore, Kandarpa is the representative of Krishna. Sometimes sex is engaged in only for sense gratification. Such sex does not represent Krishna. But sex for the generation of good children is called Kandarpa and represents Krishna. Text 29. Anantaschasminaganam varuno yadasamaham pitrinam aryamachasmi yamasam yamatamaham. Of the celestial naga snakes, I am Ananta. Ananta has thousands of hoods, thousands of headed snakes. Maybe you've seen in the zoo sometimes a two-headed snake. You never saw? I saw once. I saw in the zoo, there was a two-headed snake. So, but there are snakes with thousands of heads also, and that is Ananta. Not just an ordinary snake, but Ananta is the snake that Lord Vishnu lies on. He rests on her. While floating in the causal ocean, Ananta Shesha is there in the Garbhodak ocean. The Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is lying on Ananta. And this Ananta Shesha is such a great serpent. It's actually an incarnation of Balaram. And on his hoods, he's maintaining the universes. That's how powerful he is. He's also a great devotee of the Lord. We may say, well, how can I believe that there's a serpent that can hold universes on his head? This all sounds a little difficult to accept. But then, we have to consider, what is our experience here? We only have experience of this one planet. Some of us only have experience of this one country, or this one continent. And what is this planet in the universe? It's just an insignificant little speck, isn't it? If you take the whole universe, the whole sky, we're so insignificant. Yet we're thinking, it's like one lady was asking me on the airplane the other day. She said, do you think that there's life on other planets too, civilized life? But just see how arrogant we've become, thinking that we're the only life, we're the only advanced intelligent beings in the whole universe. There's millions and billions of planets. Isn't it silly to think like that? But yet, that's how we're thinking, because we're in ignorance. But the Vedas, if you want to have knowledge, you have to study the Vedas. Otherwise, in order to understand what's going on the other planets, you'll have to speculate. Possibly it's like this. Perhaps it's like that. Maybe there's life on other planets because we saw a blue hue. And the blue hue, it may represent that there's liquid there. And they have to speculate so many things. Maybe there's some amoebas. It is not a very perfect way of acquiring knowledge, especially when the planets are very far away. How will you can't, they're having difficulty even going to the nearest planet, the moon. Of course, they say they went there. Some people believe them. But they've certainly abandoned that whole project very quickly now. Having gone to the moon, now, okay, we conquered the moon, now let's go on to Mars. So why don't you colonize there? Why don't you make some program? Having spent so many billions of dollars, they simply give us some rocks. And you know, it's funny, they say, ironically, these rocks, they resemble very much rocks that one can get from the desert in Arizona. It's funny that they should say that, isn't it? That they look like the stones. Some people think they got them there. I saw it when I was in Washington, D.C., at the Air and Space Museum. We were chanting right outside there, so sometimes we'd go in to drink water. And I passed by, and they had one of these stones there, the moonstones. It looked just like a stone from Arizona. So I told the man who was guarding it, I said, I think this stone is from Arizona. I think it's a big hoax. What do you think? He said, well, no. Anyway, now they're going to Mars, and that will cost us, I don't know how many trillions of dollars to go there. And then after they go there. But just see how much effort, how many years we have to wait to go to the moon and to Mars. And what do they come up with? Oh, there's no life there. Doesn't support life. That's their conclusion. But the Vedas tell us that there is life on the moon. In fact, they tell us that the beings there are more advanced. It is a heavenly planet. There are people there who are more advanced, live much longer than we do, are much more intelligent, much more advanced. than we are. So why didn't our spacemen see them? There's many questions. There are many questions about this whole lunatic excursion.
They probably see something when they go back to tell the people, to go back to the nation, the picture.
Yeah. So one man wrote a book. He worked for NASA. He wrote a book about how the whole thing was a big hoax. He said they planned the splashdown in the water. They filmed it. He said he explained how they did the whole thing. Anyway, still, the best way to receive knowledge about things beyond our experience is through the Vedas, because the Veda means knowledge, and it is the perfect knowledge coming from God Himself. The Vedas, Vedaischa Sarvairahameva Vedantavid, Vedavid, Vedantakrit Vedavid. The compiler of the Vedas is God Himself. It must be perfect. He created everything. He's maintaining everything. He knows everything. If He tells us that there's life, the Gandharvas, there's a planet called Gandharva Loka, Charna Loka, Siddha Loka, so many different planets, and they have all living beings. There's also a planet of Pitris, presided over by Aryama. Pitris means the forefathers, the ancestors. The ancestors, they go to a particular, if they're very pious, and they can go to a particular place. And those who want to go there, let's say you have some great-great-grandfather who's very pious, and he's passed away, and you want to go and be with him. So there's a system. Yanti deva bataha devan patrin yanti patri bataha. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, if you worship the demigods, then you can go and live with the demigods. If you worship the forefathers, the ancestors, you can go and live with them. Some people want that. They want to go and live with them because it's very pious there. Oh, we're getting some radio. So, there is a planet where the forefathers are living. There are many living entities who give punishment to the miscreants, and among them, Yama is the chief. Yama is situated in a planet near this earthly planet, and after death, those who are very sinful are taken there, and Yama arranges different kinds of punishments for them. So, Yama is, you might say, as close as you might be able to calculate to the devil image of the West. He's not a devil, though. He's actually a great devotee. He's a wonderful demigod, wonderful pure devotee. But he has the task of dispensing punishment. Just like a judge. A judge may be a very good citizen. In fact, he must be a good citizen to get the position. But what does he have to do? He has to, all day long, all right, this man, he's a murderer. All right, give him the life sentence. This man, oh, he's a thief. All right, 20 years in prison. This man, he has to see so many criminals all day long. And he has to award them punishments suitable. All right, you did this. Okay, you get this. So on the universal scale, there's also punishments. After this life, during this life, we may be punished by the state or the judge or the police. But after this life, then there's another judgment. You know, this is all quite practical. If you understand the soul doesn't die, only the body dies, then it's very reasonable that the soul that continues would have to be responsible for his activities. Isn't it reasonable? If we're responsible in this lifetime, why should I not be responsible afterwards? Maybe I have done some things which I haven't paid for yet. Let's say, for example, in the state, it's okay. They allow eating, slaughtering animals and eating them. Right? In fact, they encourage it. I think it's quite a good, quite a jolly good thing. But it's not allowed on the universal laws. That is a great harm then, because the government is saying, yes, it's okay, you can do it. But the universal government says, uh-uh, you can't do it. So the poor people are being engaged in sinful activities without knowledge by their government. What a horrible thing. It's like if your mother gives you poison accidentally, or she administers something bad for you, what can you do? You're a child. But still you suffer. So similarly, the people, because they have bad leaders, misleaders, are suffering greatly. And now, because of all this animal slaughter, they are responsible for the killing of so many animals. And this carries very heavy reactions. Even though the state says it's quite all right, nobody goes to prison for killing cows. If you harm a dog, you'll immediately go to jail. But if you harm, you can kill as many cows as you like, millions of them, and that's all right. Cows, chickens, goats, lambs, pigs, deer. I just came from Tennessee in America, and they told me that during hunting season they kill a million deer in just that one small area. The hunters go out. It's a great sport. Real fair, isn't it? They go with their modern, you know, automatic rifles, and they go in vehicles, and they call that sporting. So that's quite all right. The government gives license. Yes, you can kill. But there's reaction for that on the universal scale. So after death, those who have committed sinful activities, they have to go, if they haven't been punished for them, then they have to go to Yamaraj. They have to see Yamaraj, the king of punishments. And Yamaraj, he has perfect notes. He's kept very good records. He's practically all-pervasive. He's so powerful that he has witnesses that will testify. The sun, the moon, the evening, the daytime, the horizon, the stars, all fire, all these different witnesses, because they're personified on the universal level. We may not see the personification of night or day or sun or fire, but they're there. These elements are representatives or the energy of persons, personifications of these things. And then ultimately, of course, the supreme judge or the supreme witness is the super soul, the Lord within the heart. He's never sleeping. He's watching everything. He knows. And Yamaraj is also such a advanced devotee and dear servant that he's in direct touch with the super soul. So he has all information. It's all there. Besides that, he's got many assistants called the Yamadutas, and they're very expert. They go, and when a sinful person is about to die, they come. You may have noticed that in many of the writings of these near-death experiences, in an uncommon number of them, they all have the same kind of a description. I was about to die, and then these gruesome people came. These with twisted faces, and they were monster-like, and they came and they had these ropes and they were dragging me out. It's a similar description, many near-death experiences. It's actually a fact. That's what the Yamadutas do, and they come and they drag him away from his body. And he's screaming, "No, no, I want to stay. Let me stay for 4 more years. I have not yet finished my plans. I have some more things to do. Just let me, I want to get, I want to get that new house over on Blueberry Hill. I have a few more things. I want to cut one more record. Let me have a chance. No. No time. You must come now, sir. No waiting. And then he's immediately brought before Yamaraj. Oh, you've done all these things. What do you have to say for yourself? Well, I didn't know. I thought it was... No. But you have to suffer now. You have to go through the different hellish planets. There are 28 planetary systems described in the Vedas. And each one of these planetary systems, there's many planets there too. So it's a whole series of hellish planets. It's not just one place, but there's a whole, and it's not all burning. You know, we have the conception of hell being, you know, a burning inferno. Well, there is some places like that, but they're not all like that. There's also oceans of pus, other nice things. Anyway, the description is given there in the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And we should be frightened. I know when I read those things, I was frightened to death. I thought, oh my God. I mean, I've already suffered. I've already had experience of suffering, even in this life. You know what it is to get agonizing pain and all kinds of psychological pains. And you see people, I remember going to school, don't they still do this in the driving education? They show you the films of the people and they get in accidents and they're all cut up and arms hanging and heads off. Have you seen that? I thought, oh, that's pretty hellish. But then I read the fifth canto and even more hellish. And you've read about in the past there were different types of religious people or so-called religious people who liked to torture others who didn't agree with them. You read about some of those tortures? Yeah, some really gruesome tortures. So I thought, my goodness, you know, there's so many hellish things that can happen to you just in this planet. What to speak of if it's a whole organized thing with all kinds of people just there specifically to cause you suffering to the most excruciating amount. I thought, I don't need to go through that again. I think I'll change my ways. So, one way or another, Krishna will attract us, either through His beauty or through His organization, His penal system. That's the way the government does it too. The government gives scholarships and awards and grants to encourage you to do the right thing, right? But if you don't, then they have prisons, penitentiaries, different kinds of punishments, fines, so many things. One way or another, they want you to become a good citizen. So, we should also become good human beings, good citizens, good spirit souls, and give up our evil ways and become a nice devotee of Krishna. Live a very pious life, very happy life, free from sinful activities. So how can you do that? You may ask, well, yes, that sounds good. I'd like to give up my bad habits, but, it's not easy. The spirit's willing, but the flesh is weak and, you know, all these cliches. We give you the solution, if you'll take it. Associate with the devotees. That's all you have to do. Just give up the other association and come and associate with devotees, and you'll see the difference. Everything will be changed. You'll no more meat eating. There's no question of eating meat. No more drinking, no more smoking. Automatically, you won't have the inclination for these things. Because in this atmosphere, it's not necessary, it's not required. And you'll be tasting such nice foodstuffs, you won't even miss eating meat. You won't even think about it again. In fact, when you think about it, you'll think, how did I ever eat those bloody dead carcasses? How could I do that? What was I, crazy? What, wasn't I even thinking? That's what you'll conclude. And the other things too, you won't need them. But that's the sign of sincerity. If someone is sincere and he actually wants to get free from, then he has to associate with the devotees. If he prefers to keep associating with non-devotees, person is engaged in sinful activities, then, okay, then birds of a feather flock together. So that is a simple process. And it's recommended in all the scriptures. Sadhu sangha, sadhu sangha, sarva shastra koi, lava matra sarva sangha, sarva siddhi hoy. One gets perfection by associating with the sadhus, saintly person. It's a very great opportunity that this center is here in the middle of Amsterdam. Sinful Amsterdam. Not just that, everywhere is sinful. But, you know, this is no exception. Where will you get shelter? And now you have this opportunity. Take advantage of it. Don't waste the human form of life just following the crowd, and you'll meet them all in, you know, Yama's court. Hell, I'll meet you in the hellish planets. We can go through some sufferings. We can go through some punishments together. Yeah, I'll meet you there. Yeah, which one are you going to? Oh, I'm going to the ocean of pus. Or are you going? I'm going to the one where, you know, you embrace the red hot iron form of a woman, and you know. Ah! I'll be there for a while. No, I'm going to the one where they pour the molten hot iron down your throat. You know, that's a nice one. No, I'm going to the one where the dogs and the other animals, they bite you and they rip you to shreds. And even though you're ripped to shreds, then somehow or other you still go on living and you're just suffering. It's no joke. These things are real. It's real. These Vedic scriptures are not, they're not just written to frighten us. It's very scientific knowledge, written by great sages who have no business just trying to unnecessarily scare us. Because everything else they say is so perfect, so scientific. In fact, they describe to the most minute atomic details everything. So why should they suddenly start exaggerating? There may have been others in different cultures who did exaggerate. And that's unfortunate that the people now have lost their faith. Because if someone says you go there and you burn eternally, well, that's not true. The Vedas don't describe eternal damnation, but they do describe that there are these sufferings. Then afterwards, you get another material body. In other words, the suffering that you get is designed to make you willing to accept whatever body you're offered. Because for a human being to have to take the body of a worm directly would be very difficult. So he gets this type of punishment, so he's willing. Yes, I'll be happy to take the body of a worm. And he's quite suitable for that. He has the right mentality. Then he gets another body, and he works his way up again, and he gets another chance at human life. And when he gets that human form of life, that's the crossroads. He can go up, or he can go down. That's his choice. So we have to decide which way we want to go. We can go up, we can go all the way back to Krishna Loka. We can go back for eternal bliss and knowledge. And it's not so difficult. Just chant Hare Krishna and take prasadam. You have to eat anyway, why not eat Krishna prasadam? You have to have some friends, why not make the devotees your friends? They're very nice people. You have to see something, some beautiful forms, why not see the beautiful form of Krishna? Learn to appreciate that. It's just a question of training. So any questions? How the different demigods gave birth to different types of species? Well, they were specifically empowered to do that. They were called Prajapatis, and they were specially empowered to do that, just as we're we're able to create only human beings by our offspring. And dogs can produce other dogs, and cows can produce other cows, and cockroaches can produce other cockroaches. But these particular persons, in the beginning of creation, they were empowered to create many of them at the same time, all the reptile species, all the trees species at the same time. That was how the Lord decided to arrange for the creation of 8,400,000 different species. In other words, we may simplify it, just like in the Christian tradition, it's simplified that God said, let there be, you know, this species, and then they came into being. God said, let there be this. Yes, that's true, but the Vedas go into more detail. God said, let there be, through his Prajapatis, and then they arranged it like that. So it's scientifically described. It's not so difficult to understand. When even a human mother gives birth to the baby human, also worms come out. They also are living there. So she's giving birth to, you know, a baby human and some worms. So there's a few different species, maybe some germs also, several different germ species. That's possible. Anything's possible by the will of the Lord. I mean, it's inconceivable. It's inconceivable how a human woman and man could combine together and produce another child, isn't it? We've just come to accept it because we see it going on. But try to think about it. How could you? We don't know what's going on. We don't have anything consciously. We're creating the next human being. We don't know how it's done. It's all inconceivable to us, isn't it? I mean, we don't know how the seed is carried there within the male semina and passed on to the female, and then how the ingredients from her body are going together, and there's a little child there. It starts off, you can't even see it. These things are all inconceivable by the grace of the Lord.